second guys, I normally have my outlines up and running before I get going, and there it is. Okay. So I want to sort of wrap up our time together here with a discussion about whether there's, beyond the answers dealing with the difficult issues on gender and race, need of deconstruction, what is the meaning? Can we actually find some level of hope here in the world? In fact, I'm going to tell you that I think that not only the deconstruction phenomenon, but a lot of the issues that are besetting human beings all over the world, especially here in the West in surprising ways, have to do with meaninglessness. There is a sense of this meaninglessness that people are struggling with. By all statistical assessments, anxiety among young people has never been higher. Which is interesting because it's never been more comfortable, physically comfortable, to be alive than now in the West. And yet the anxiety is at all-time highs for a number of reasons. I think that this foisting on people of the idea that you can determine who you are and what you are at like 8 or 9 has created a tremendous amount of anxiety. I just figured out who I am a little while ago. I'm 49 years old. If you're a 9-year-old, you can figure it out. By the way, I'm going to seal the deal. Tremendous anxiety, amongst many other things. The strife that's going on, the hostility with which we interact on social media, and all these things, and then the competition to keep up, whether it's young people who are seeing images on Instagram or Snapchat or whatever it is, and saying TikTok and saying, I'll never live up to that, or that person follows and likes are so much greater than mine, that no one likes me, and by comparison, I'm just a bad person, whatever it is. You know, it's staggering the way in which people actually have found themselves in a state of meaninglessness. But we think about the meaning of life and we say, we don't know what it actually is, and it's the hardest question in the world to answer. I think about this just a scene in the movie City Slickers. Have you seen this movie? It's like the late 80s, I think it is, in the early 90s. And you know the story essentially is that Billy Crystal plays this guy who lives in New York, and I think he sells radio advertisement time. And he goes to find himself out in the wilderness, like somewhere like Montana he would do, and he would do this cattle ranching thing to see what kind of a man he really is and what he's really made of to find some kind of meaning in life. And sort of the catalyst for this is this time he goes, he's like having a midlife crisis, he doesn't know if his life means anything really, has he done anything great really, and he finds himself at career day at his school, you know, and people are meeting up there and talking about to the kids, what do I do for a living? Firefighters, what's more exciting than that? I'm a policeman, that's really cool. I'm a lawyer, I do this kind of complex stuff. I'm a doctor, and all these glamorous and cool and exciting things, and he sells advertising space on a radio station. So he's like, this job, what? You know, this is where I'm at now? So this is what he says, these young people, about, so he derails from saying what he does for a living, this is what he says. Value this time in your life, kids, because this is the time in your life when you still have your choices. It goes by fast. When you're a teenager, you think you can do anything, and you do. Your 20s are a blur. 30s, you raise your family, you make a little money, and you think to yourself, what happened to my 20s? 40s, you grow a little pot belly, you grow another chin. The music starts to get too loud, one of your old girlfriends from high school becomes grandmother. 50s, you have a minor surgery. You'll call it a procedure, but it's a surgery. 60s, you have a major surgery. The music is still too loud, but it doesn't matter because you can't hear it. Your 70s, you and the wife retire to Fort Lauderdale. You start eating dinner at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. You have lunch around 10, breakfast the night before, and spend most of your time wandering around malls looking for the ultimate soft yogurt and muttering, why don't the kids call anymore? Why don't the kids call anymore? In your 80s, you'll have a major stroke. You end up battling with some Jamaican nurse whom your wife can't stand, but who you call her. Any questions? This is sort of what in the world, you know? This is the way life is supposed to be. So you get this sense that it's all meaningless. Because you're looking for the world to satisfy that sense of meaning. You're looking for your circumstance that says I have that sense of meaning. And absent a transcendent source for that meaning, I don't think Billy Crystal is all that wrong. Really isn't, because I remember reading or watching another movie. I get a lot of positions from movies, by the way. It was called Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead. And there's this guy who sets up a business and he does these video messages to people. So the person who's dying, who's terminally ill, sends a message to their loved ones and gives advice and all this stuff, and he arranges the funerals and plays this thing. In other words, you give your own eulogy. And there's this guy, this old sort of cantankerous guy, who's talking about life, and he's saying, basically, this life is over. He says, life is like a mustard burp, momentarily tangy, and then gone with the wind. Which is a disgusting way to refer to it. But it's a hopeless way to refer to it as well. It really is. Now, you know, there's people who would talk to you about the meaning of life, and does it have any sense of meaning? And there are people who are pretty honest about the fact that even though we try to fool ourselves into thinking there's meaning, there really isn't any meaning. Take Richard Dawkins, for example. Richard Dawkins, one of the world's most famous atheists, he said this: if the universe were just electrons and selfish genes, meaningless tragedy are exactly what we should expect, along with equally meaningless good fortune. Such a universe would be neither evil nor good in intention. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. So, if you've lost a loved one when you were young and you're talking to a guy, you talk about that, and there is no God, then there is no design, there is no purpose, no evil, and no good. There are just meaningless tragedies and equally meaningless good fortune. It doesn't mean anything. It was Lawrence Krauss, the astrophysicist out of Arizona State University, at least he was from Arizona State University. He was asked in a newspaper, what is the meaning of life? And he says, basically, we're completely irrelevant. We are basically, I think he called it essentially cosmic refuse for just the flotsam and jetsam of the universe. If you remove human beings, all the planets, all the stars, everything that's out there would largely be the same. We are completely irrelevant. Julian Dagen, an atheist who's incredibly honest about the implications of his worldview, he says atheists have to live with the knowledge that there is no salvation, no redemption, no second chances. Lives can go terribly wrong in ways that can never be put right. Can you really tell the parents who lost their child to suicide after years of depression that they should just stop worrying and enjoy their life? See, he's responding to something. Dagen's responding to something really important here. Dagen made the claim. The British Humanist Association was putting on the sides of these buses and on these billboards all over Britain posters that said, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. That's a weird thing to say in many ways, but the claim of the idea of religion is basically a worrisome affair. You're worried, did you please this God enough? Are you following the right religion? He says, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and just enjoy your life. Now, a couple things wrong with that. Not only is that a mischaracterization of the Christian religion, but it's also an interesting thing. You say there's probably no God. Does that help you not worry? I mean, look, I remember doing a hike out in California in these mountains, and there was a sign that had a rattlesnake on it, which told me there are rattlesnakes in there. So I wanted to go on hike anyway, just be aware of rattlesnakes. If the sign had said there's probably no rattlesnakes, would that help me at all? What a weird thing to say. They just said, okay. But Dagen's pointing out, he's saying, in the throes of life, when life goes horribly wrong in ways that can't be put right, can you really help someone by saying there's probably no God and stop worrying and enjoy your life? They can't. That's the problem. You're basically saying, don't feel like a human. And it doesn't get you anywhere. I think a robust Christian faith helps us in the midst of these things that are terrible, but also in the midst of our joys. We were talking about that over here next to the podium, but one thing that Christians sometimes seem to lack is an expression of joy, and we have a tremendous reason to be joyful. But I want to give you a couple of ways in which I think that Christian faith specifically, believing God, the Christian faith specifically, gives you a sense of meaning in several ways. The first thing is that if there is a God, and if there is a purpose behind everything, and it's not just blind, pitiless, and different, then what we do, everything we do, has some level of significance. You know, as I grew up, I was trained as a lawyer, went to law school, and I was a litigator, as I said before. And one of the things you do in law school is you read a lot of famous opinions by really well-known jurists, people who were judges down through the decades of legal jurisprudence in America and around the world as well. And there's one particular guy, his name is Richard Posner. Richard Posner was the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals judge, absolutely brilliant man. No one doubts his brilliance at all. Not everyone agrees with him, but he's a brilliant, brilliant jurist. In fact, so brilliant is Richard Posner that oftentimes, even if you weren't in his district, if his opinions weren't actually binding authority, you would cite his opinions as persuasive authority because that's how respected he was across the United States in terms of his jurisprudential acumen, the way his brilliance. So I remember really admiring this guy in the way he thought, in the way he would write, in the way he would think. So I'm like, wow, this is a noble profession. Being a lawyer is a noble profession. Being a judge is a noble profession. It serves a higher calling. Then I saw a video, a YouTube video of Jeff Posner, and they were talking about his judicial philosophy. And he said basically this. This is what he said. This is his judicial philosophy. This is how he sees his job. He says, human beings are just monkeys with big brains. That's it. So deflated by that. Really? Let's go, here's my question then. This brilliant man who's done so much for the advancement of American jurisprudence. If we're just monkeys with big brains, then how are you part of a higher calling of jurists who adjudicate the disputes among men and women in a way that seeks for justice and fairness so that we can have a better society? How is that what you're actually doing, as opposed to just being a zookeeper who keeps the monkeys from biting each other? That's all we do. We're just monkeys with big brains. That reminds me of another conversation I had with a guy. He was a doctor, and a very successful doctor at that, by the way. And so he had become an atheist, and we were having a conversation, talking about God and other things. We were talking about a lot of things, but we had a discussion about God and other things. And my wife had a brilliant question for him. Now, it seems like it was an American kind of question, but it was a great question because he was doing a lot of good things for people. He was doing medical missions overseas. He was volunteering his time. He was just doing wonderful things for a lot of people, and he didn't need belief in God to do it. He just did it because he wanted to do it, which is great, and I'm fine with that. But she said, hey, what gets you up in the morning? What inspires you? She wants to know. He's a very successful guy with all these people. What inspires you? You know, he gave him this American answer to this American question. He says, people. Helping people inspires me. So I'm a smart aleck. So I said, why? And he said, what do you mean, why? Like, the answer is evident. It's self-evident. It's obvious. Because they're people. No, why? Seriously, I want to know why that inspires you at all. What about that inspires you instead of just occupying your time? What's good about that? Seriously, are you asking this? And so I said, well, here's the thing. We've been talking about, you know, atheism and God, and you basically have told me that you think that we're here by accident. We're not actually specially created. There's no real ultimate purpose of humanity. There's no ultimate meaning. Just the meaning we give life of ourselves. It's meaningful if we give it meaning, but that meaning is totally subjective and all these things. We're just big, complicated biochemical machines. Right? That's what you believe. He said, yeah. I said, well, let me ask you a question then. If you believe in the nobility and the inspiring nature of your calling to be a doctor where you help people in their deepest physical needs, how is that possible if we're just biochemical machines? Aren't you just an expensively educated mechanic? You're just one machine working on other machines. He didn't like that at all. Now, we didn't get into a fight. We had a relationship where I could talk like this. But here's the thing I mentioned at the end of our discussion. The reality is this, that if you are a part of a plan, if there is a transcendent source for not only morality but also meaning in the universe, then everything you do, whether you're a judge or you're a doctor or you're a mechanic, all of it has a value beyond the immediate circumstances. You're just not part of a system that puts food on the table and procreates, and that's what we do. There's more to it than that. There's more to it. What we do not only affects human beings who are physical beings, but you're affecting people in a positive way, no matter what your job actually is, who are made in God's image. There is a purpose and design that outlives you. And by the way, if that's true, you are with you. With eternal is all this. Everything we do has a purpose, and it matters, no matter what it actually is. So I think that the Christian faith will essentially tell you that we have this sense of meaning and purpose. Objectively so. The second thing that it does for us is that belief in God, understanding that God actually exists, gives a real sense of meaning to our wonder and our imagination. You know, we're always looking for our place in this world. Why am I here? What am I doing here? And all these things in terms of imagination. But there's actually a purpose behind this. That's not just this non-explained thing. I mean, think about this. We have scientists who want to know, the James Webb Telescope, I don't know if you know about this thing, the James Webb Telescope is the best telescope there is now, and we see further and further into the world, out into the universe, and we see our ancient past, and we get more explanations of how things came to be, and how things are, and what things are made of, and what stars are no longer there that we thought were there one time. All this great stuff we're getting. Why do we care? You know who doesn't care? Apes. They sit around eating bananas and do whatever apes do. They don't care what the moon's a Saturn made of. It doesn't matter them one bit. And you know what's happening? You know what's funny? It doesn't hurt them that they don't know that. It doesn't prevent them from procreating their species and fostering their DNA. Richard Dawkins was asked, what are we here for? And he says, we are machines for propagating DNA. It is every living object's sole reason for living. That's what Dawkins says. Well, then why do we care what the center of the sun is like? Why do we care about any of this stuff? Because there's a wonder and imagination built into us that isn't evolutionary. There's nothing evolutionary about some of this stuff. Apes get along just fine. Amoeba and plankton and blue whales and all these things get along just fine without knowing if it's a stratus cloud or a cumulonimbus cloud. They get along just fine without it. But there's something about this idea of imagination that gives us a sense of purpose and a setting within a grander scheme of things that inspires us, that even despite our circumstances, we can wonder at that which is to come. We can have a wonder at that which is to come. And it gives meaning to our imagination. You know, C.S. Lewis once said that reason is the natural organ of truth, but imagination is the natural organ of meaning. Reason is the natural organ of truth, but imagination is the natural organ of meaning. You can have this whole thing where you can apply something and be creative in a way where you take logic, you take facts, then you apply them, you create works of fiction, you create movies, you create poetry, you create art, we create all these songs, all this wonderful stuff that conveys to us truth we otherwise wouldn't get deep in our hearts if they were conveyed to us in a bland fashion. But poetry has a way of doing it. I quoted two poems yesterday from Phyllis Wheatley and from John Greenleaf Whittier. And I have plenty of poems in my head because they stuck in my head because they convey propositional truths, things of reason, in ways that are imaginative, and it's given my life meaning. Not just because it's my life and it's a temporary thing, but because it objectively is true and it sticks. And so, yes, we have lots of things that we do in this world. We build machines, we build computers, we build all these things. But these are just expressions, I think, of the image of God on us, which is a creative image. And it's beautiful. So, you know, there's this movie, another movie illustration. There's this in a book called Contact. Did you ever see this movie or hear this movie? Contact. So the premise of the book, written by Carl Sagan, by the way, it's a semi-autobiographical book. Carl Sagan was a scientist who wrestled with belief in God. He thought that, you know, the universe is all there is, all there will be, and all this kind of stuff. And so he would say he didn't believe in God, but he wrestled with it a little bit. He seemed quite strident in his atheism, but there were times when Carl actually wrestled with belief that maybe there is a God out there. And so this movie, Contact, or this book, if you will, Contact, is about a scientist who discovers a hidden message from aliens about how to build a machine that will get human beings to those aliens. And so the story goes that this machine is built, and the scientist gets to go in the pod that will transport the person to the alien encounter. And that person has the alien encounter, and there's no evidence of it whatsoever, except for that person's testimony. But the evidence seems to go contrary to his actual experience. And so he's asking people to believe him about his experience on faith. And there's this whole juxtaposition of how do we actually wrestle with faith and reason and these kind of things. But the reason I bring this book up and this movie up is that there's a scene at the end where the scientist, Ali Arnaway, is now she's back and she's giving a tour of the very large array, which is all these series of radars that point towards the heavens trying to see if there's extraterrestrial life out there. She's giving a tour to young people. And the young people, and one of the young folks says to her, is there life out there? And she says, what do you think? He says, I don't know. She goes, well, good, you're a skeptic, I like that. And she said, well, let me tell you something, the universe is bigger than anything that one's ever imagined. So if it's just us, it's an awful waste of space. I remember seeing that and thinking to myself, that's a weird answer. I find it weird. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. But here's the thing. When you actually study science, and you begin to see just how absolutely privileged, there's a whole movie on this called Privileged Planet, where we sit in the Goldilocks zone, and how things that are billions of miles away actually affect our planet and our placement. In fact, other galaxies have an effect on our galaxy and our solar system. That everything is set just in place so that we can exist. When you see this stuff, you think, there's this wonderful dance out there in the universe that isn't really a waste of space. It might be so that this planet can exist the way it does. But even if it didn't, what we could look at it, because all of it was pre-designed, what we could look at it is not a big waste of space, but a God who is not only an engineer, but also an artist. He's just showing off. And he wants you to discover it. Proverbs 25, verse 2, interesting verse in the Bible. So I remember I was giving a talk, a friend of mine was giving a talk, and I was running for Q&A at a university on the interaction of science and faith. You know, has science put God on the job kind of thing. And he gives a great presentation on how science has done no such thing. In fact, it was Christianity that inspired the great works of science that we see today. So a young guy gets up at the back of the room and he says, look, my problem with religion is that essentially it's a science stopper. You don't know how something happened. Religion says God did it, and that stops the whole exploration. It's over. So I answered the question. I said, you know, it's funny you say that because I don't know one person who thinks like that. Yeah. I'm not aware of one Christian who thinks don't have to explain how lightning happens. God did it. It's like Zeus or something. No one thinks like this. But anyway, he said it. I said, you know, it's interesting you say that because a couple of things. One is when you look at the ENCODE project, there's this project called the ENCODE project, where you look at DNA, and it's long been known that only about 4% of the DNA strand actually does anything that encodes for proteins. So the rest of it seems non-functional. We call it junk DNA. And the theory was that the junk DNA is a vestige of evolution, that over time, all these different strands of DNA from human beings basically was rendered obsolete as we got better and better over time, and so that stuff still exists in our DNA, but it doesn't do anything. And so it doesn't encode for proteins and that kind of thing. So we assume it does nothing. But the ENCODE project comes along and says, hey, maybe this isn't junk. Maybe we should look at it more and see if it's actually designed or some kind of purpose behind this. And the more and more they study it, the more and more they find that the so-called junk DNA actually has a purpose. It helps the other 4% actually do something. You're seeing it more and more and more. And I said, you know what's interesting is that if we had assumed that we started from a designless beginning, that there was nothing previsioning us, no purpose behind us, and we just evolved by random chance, then yeah, we would assume there's junk DNA. But we'd also not look for the purpose of it. But let's say we had assumed that everything has a purpose and design to it. Maybe we wouldn't have thought it's junk DNA decades and decades ago. Maybe we would have said, hey, maybe there actually is purpose to this. We would have looked at it, and we would have found those answers decades before we found them now. In other words, if we assume that someone had designed this thing, maybe we've actually discovered some things ahead of time. Science, faith is not a science stopper. Maybe it's a science starter. But it's interesting too, Proverbs 25, verse 2. It says, it is the glory of God to conceal a matter. It is the glory of kings to seek things out. That's interesting. You know, my boy, Yusuf, at a young age, had an affinity for letters and numbers. Had an affinity for them. Loved them. And so like every good first-time dad, I wrote a report. And I bought every conceivable toy you could think of that had letters and numbers on it, because of course mine is a 3-month old. It's going to be something to solve the equations of the universe, and I'm going to have a cure for cancer in a couple of years. So we buy him this laptop. It's not really a laptop, it's a Spider-Man speak and spell, but it's a laptop to fool the kid and didn't get a computer. So we're sitting there at a table, and it's my wife and I talking, and Yusuf is sitting at the table, and he's got this laptop open, this speak and spell open, and my wife and I are talking, and suddenly I hear my son. He goes, "Fat, fat." I look over and sure on the screen, F-A-T. He's a little early, by the way, so. He reads this letter because these were F-A-T, and I'm like, he's read that word. So I hit the next word button, and C-A-T pops up. He goes, cat? Cat? I'm like, holy crow! So I'm hitting the next word button as fast as I possibly can. Cat, back, rap, fat. You know, he's just going back and on and on and on. He's reading three-letter words like a champ. You know, and I'm like, oh my goodness, this is fantastic. He is squealing in delight, and I guarantee you I was happier than he was. So I'm delighting in his discovery. And so what the Bible tells us in Proverbs 25, verse 2, is that it is the glory of God to conceal a matter, not so that we don't discover it, but so that we can engage in the delight of discovery like my son had. And of the two of us, whether it's we who discover things, or whatever it might be, and God, as he sees us discover things, I guarantee you his delight is greater. God does not encourage ignorance. He encourages discovery. He encourages that discovery, and it gives meaning and purpose. This world is intelligible, and it's quite mystifying that it's intelligible at all, because if odds were, it was going to be unintelligible, and yet here we are, able to make sense of it. Einstein actually made that statement. He said, one of the biggest things I find to be so mysterious about the universe is that I can't understand it at all. And he even admitted, though I wouldn't say he was a believer in God in any sense that we would think of as Christians, he admitted, he said, look, we have to look at this universe and stand back in awe that there's something behind this other than just atoms and quarks and forces. There's something behind us, and be humble about that reality. Be humble about that reality. So it gives a sense of imagination, but it also gives a sense of faith and hope and love in a real sense. In a real sense. Now, we were talking earlier today over there about the sense of worth, and that we actually have some kind of meaning and purpose in this life. And this world can knock it out of you. I told you a story yesterday about the guy who called me a camel jockey and tried to make it seem like I wasn't worth anything because of my ethnicity. And someone candidly shared with me today that they were made to feel that way by someone close to them. They were made to feel like they were worth nothing. But I'm going to tell you, if there's no God and no one seems to value you, I can see why young people are in the state of anxiety that are today. I get it. Why wouldn't you be? But if there's a God who loves you, who created you on purpose, even if everyone seems to run from you, and I guarantee you it's not everyone, it seems that way. You can be loved by someone who so infinitely loved you that he showed it to you. Let me finish with this illustration. I think we go until in a regular call when we go through, but it's not 10:45, that's for sure. Friend of mine and I were having a conversation. He was an atheist. And we were in school together and we talked about a lot of stuff, but not religion. For whatever reason, matters of faith didn't come up between the two of us. But he turned out he brought that from a Christian, wanted to know why. I told him why, gave him the story. And I knew he was an atheist, and he basically disclosed to me why. I hadn't discussed it before, but he told me why. He said essentially he gave up any faith in God because his mother died when he was 10. So he was 38 years old at the time he told me the story. So 28 years of atheism. And when he told me that story, you could easily see on his face that the atheism he had come to believe provided him no satisfaction whatsoever. Because if there is no God, then his mother's death was meaningless. In fact, her life was meaningless. And in fact, his grief is meaningless. He was wrestling with this. He said, look, I have a hard time believing that God is good, and that God valued my mother or me. If you let that happen to her, it happened to me when I was so young. You know, in that moment, what do? Do you tell somebody, here's four syllogisms of the problem of evil and why God exists and even evil exists? No. We've already done that, by the way, by the time this discussion has happened. We've already gone through some of that stuff. But if you empathize, I've lost people in my life, but never someone that close to me at such a tender age. So I can't even, I can only imagine what it's like for a 10-year-old boy to lose a mother he loves that much. So, you know, here's the thing though, okay? We've gone through some reasons why God could exist in a world full of suffering. I said, you agreed to be there, we went back and forth and said, you agreed that God could exist in a world where suffering exists because God could allow suffering, not cause it, but could allow it for a greater possible good that could come in the future. We might never see it in this lifetime, but it's possible that God, who knows all things, would allow something to happen because a greater good could come. He said, yeah. I said, that's a theory. He said, yeah, that's all it is. I'm like, you know, that's a theory. It gives you no comfort. He said, no, it doesn't give you any comfort at all. But you know, anybody can say that. I mean, Muslim can say that, a Jew can say that, Buddhist, some extremists of Buddhism can say that, Hindus can say that, how it works in mysterious ways. A nice bumper sticker, but it doesn't help anybody. Can I tell you something though? As a Christian, I don't have a theory. I have a reality. God could allow suffering for a greater possible good. I believe that because God did allow suffering of his own son, the greatest possible good there could be, the salvation of the whole world. That's historically a fact. It's a fact. You ask me one of the questions, how can I know that God values me or my mother? How do I know that we have meaning? So how do you know anything has value? How do you know anything has value? You know what the value of something is by what you're willing to pay for it. And you can realize that. That you and your mother have an infinite value because the infinite God paid an infinite price to spend eternity with you both. That's an objective fact, too. If the universe is all there is no meaning. But if God is the one who, in whom the universe has its existence, then everything is pregnant with meaning, even our tragedies. Even our tragedies. The cross gives us that over and over again. Humanity's in search of it. We don't need to be Billy Crystal and go find it in the wilderness. We don't need to give up the faith thinking it goes somewhere else. It doesn't. Even in places like Russia, I remember sitting next to a guy who had given numbers. He would tell me that it was pretty tough living in former Soviet Russia. And the bread lines would be long, and hope was just gone. In fact, Russia was intentionally atheistic. My friend Stuart McAllister used to bring Bibles, smuggle Bibles on the Iron Curtain, and look at the borders. They'd ask him a question: do you have guns? Do you have drugs? Do you have Bibles? Which is an interesting triad. But they feared Bibles that much, and they wanted to stamp out of the Russian mindset, the Soviet mindset, just religion was bad. Did you know what's interesting? The reason we were talking was because my daughter, Nadia, the youngest, Nadia, she's flippy. She's constantly tumbling and doing something when she was young. We were at this pool party, sitting next to this guy, and she had done a flip of some kind in the pool. He said, is that your kid? And I said, yeah, that's my child. What's your name? I said, Nadia. He goes, Nadia, this is a Russian name. I said, well, it's Middle Eastern to a Travis, you know, it's a passport. He says, you know what this means? I said, what does it mean in Russian? He says, it means hope. So there's a popular name in Russian stuff? He goes, oh, my goodness. He goes, the three most popular names, get this now. The three most popular names for girls in Soviet, intentionally atheistic Russia were Vera, Nadyashda, and Lubov. Faith, hope, and love. Russian people found meaning despite the confiscation of their Bibles because they preserved this message of 1 Corinthians 13 in the names of their daughters. The Christian faith is impossible to escape. I appreciate that there are some things that are existential threats to Christendom, but not to the gospel. If Russia can't do it, thank you.
thank you for coming. Give him a hand. Aki has a couple of other assistants. One is in the book. Your former assistant's name was what?
Tara.
And Tara and I used to talk on the phone. I will tell you the stories of what we hoped to do last summer. Tara's story in this book is worth the book in and of itself. He also has a current assistant named Dominique Cochran. She is in the hospital right now with COVID. Will you pray with me for Dominique? Father, we just lift that young lady to you in the name of Jesus. And your word still tells us to speak healing to her. And so we agree this morning that you will watch over her, that you will let no thing come against her that's on the outside of your will, and that there will be purpose even in this sickness that will come about for your glory. Touch her, reassure her, Lord, this morning. In Jesus' name. And everybody said,
Amen.
One other thing I have to ask before we have some questions for about 10 minutes. How many of you know, does anybody know, how to get the recordings on our website? Where do you go? How loud?
To the media section?
To the media section. The recordings from the last three sessions are already on our webpage. Abdu, thank you so much for coming again. You could be 100 other places, and we feel blessed that you've been with us. Now we are going to take short questions and short answers.
All right. So, yeah, go ahead and raise your hand, and then they'll you fire up immediately. There we go.
Okay, so this is kind of a personal question, so up to you.
Oh boy.
But I don't know on your podcast if you've done your biggest woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Oh, so I'm not going to tell you what it is, because I have. And I want you to go to the podcast and watch it. It's free, no obligation. So it has to do with, I shared a couple of them, by the way, on the podcast.
Which episode?
Episode one. In fact, Derek is my first guest, and he shares his. By the way, listen to him, he's got a great lesson, he's going to show it. I share mine, they're right now available, but listen to it now, I'll hear it if you do it. If I hear me, I can have it. There's some good show that out there. I've had a lot of them, I gotta tell you. And I'll just tell you the principles behind some of these. Most of my good show that has happened because I didn't listen. This is ironic, friends, because I teach a lot about how important it is to listen. People engage in what I call yeah, but syndrome. They have this thing where no matter what you're saying, they're saying yeah, but, they can't wait for the next rush or something. And they can't wait for you to stop saying something so they can start. But they're not listening to you. I've had that happen before. I preach against this, and I do it all the time. I try my best to not do it, but I've done it plenty of times. I've also had times when I've lost my cool. In fact, the first episode, I'll talk about a time when I had a Q&A with an atheist guy. I lost my cool in a Q&A. And I'm pretty good at not losing my cool. This guy pushed the buttons. And the problem was, there were other buttons being pushed that day that led me there. I'm sure you can relate, where you've lost it because of something else, not the person who actually got that at. And I did it in public at a microphone. Anyway, that's one of my coulda, shoulda was. I remember that one pretty good. I'm pretty embarrassed by it. But I shared it with the whole world the other day. So go on coulda, shoulda, woulda. Go to our Obbury official, youtube.com/Obbury official. And subscribe, by the way. If you subscribe, you'll be updated with everything new happens on the website, on the YouTube channel. You can also go to our website to see this stuff too. We have a whole video section. The videos are populated there as well. Great question. You're the first one to ask me about it. I'm so happy about that. Another question, please.
Thank you. So I just got this book, Letter to the American Church, by your friend Eric Metaxas. So can you summarize briefly everything you said yesterday, today? What would you say to the American church?
Oh, okay. So headline, we need to do better. We need to do better in a number of areas. We need to do better by shoring up and understanding the truth and realizing the value of truth and not giving in to mere emotion. We also need to do better by listening to people's emotions. Okay, these are the crux of the matter. This is the tension. You see, we're big on truth, and I have a whole thing tomorrow at Word of Life. If you're not going, I'll give you a tiny snippet of preview. We're big on truth as a church. You know, we say it all the time. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and all this stuff. And we say the Bible is the truth, and we believe it, and all that. And someone asks you to defend it. We kind of stumble on this a little bit, but we are still adamant about it. We still are fist shaky about it. And I say Jesus is the only way to salvation. And someone says, "Amen." And I'm like, "Why do you think that?" And a little bit more quiet now. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. We need to shore up the reasons we have for the hope we have. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, when Peter says, "Be always prepared to have a reason for the faith you have," what he says is, a reason for the hope you have, but do it with gentleness and respect. He also says this, always be prepared to provide a reason for the hope you have to anyone who asks. This is part two. Know the truth, but be a person who's so joy-filled and so hope-filled that someone wants to say to you, "What's with you, man? Why do you have that hope and that joy?" So the church needs to be solid on the truth, needs to be solid on our hope and our joy, and it needs to be willing to listen to people. Because if they disagree with you and they have these hurts, we need to hear why they are where they're at. There's a million reasons why. There's some great books on that table that help you with that. Carl Truman's books are great on that. I wrote a book called Saving Truth, all about this, how did we get here in the first place. But a big part of our impact will be listening. A big part of it will be listening. If we don't listen, we're answering a question no one asked. I think it's an important part of it. So thank you for the question. Absolutely. Another one.
Thank you for being here. And, we're on our way to Mars. Are we going to be optimistic or pessimistic?
About life on Mars?
What our goal is as humans, that'll probably be a mini nation effort, you know, so.
Sure. Well, I'll tell you what, this is actually a lovely thing. I love that they're trying to go to Mars. I think it's fantastic. I don't know if we're going to find anything on Mars, but other than Mars, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Here's what's going to happen. Okay? Here's what I predict. I could be completely wrong about this, and so if I'm made a fool of later on, I'm happily made a fool of this. But what we're going to find, I think, is some remarkable discoveries about the formation of the solar system, and I think we're going to see God's handiwork behind it. Now, will that be headlines? God created Mars. It's not going to be on front page of U.S. today. But what will be is the facts that can lead you to believe this kind of thing. So I think the very fact that we, with our intelligence, can build machines that get us there is an expression of God's indelible image in each one of us. You know, look at this machine right here, right? This laptop that's projecting these things on these screens, or the one that I'm holding in my hand, or the ones that you have in your pockets, or the thing that's allowing my voice to be projected out of these speakers. All of these things are ingenious creations. They're ingenious. They're all amazing. People do their taxes on those machines, right? If I told you that machine was created because of a whirlwind in a parts supply shop, and I said, "Now do your taxes on it," you'd be like, "Sure, good idea." No, if I told you that was designed by some of the finest computer engineering minds in the country, you'd be okay with it. Your brain is far more complex than that thing. Your brain made that thing. Why would you trust your brain if it was made by a random act in a parts supply company? In other words, there's got to be a mind behind it. So So the fact that we can go to Mars points me to the one who made Mars in the first place. And these are the things we should strive to do because it reveals God's handiwork. Francis Bacon was credited as saying, "Oh God," the scientist, "Oh God, I find myself as I discover your universe, thinking your thoughts after you." I think it's wonderful in that, wonderful in that. So who knows what we'll find, but I'm sure it'll glorify God. One more. Do you know how fast it is?
So, given the state of the university system, are you going to send your kids to university?
I already have, actually.
Oh.
My son's at Michigan State University,
okay.
Where I'm happy to report, at least by all indications, as far as I know from him, that he is socially, academically, and spiritually doing well there. You know, you can have two thoughts on the American university system. And I fault no one for either option. Okay? The one option is these are indoctrination institutions, and we ought to keep our kids away from them because we're paying them to knock the faith out of our children. Okay? That's one way to look at it, and that's certainly not without warrants. There's plenty of warrants for that belief, and we can take some of the Christian schools. By the way, there are plenty of Christian schools in name only. So you gotta be careful. Choose your school wisely. There's some great Christian schools, some great ones. Some of the board trustees of Waldo, a small Christian school in Michigan, it's Green Arbor. And I would happily recommend you to take some of the kids there. Are there challenges at that school? You bet. I've spoken at lots of schools, Christian schools, and I hear the stories. And there's challenges there too. A lot of the sexual sort of mores and norms and ethics in our Christian schools, not because the professors or teachers are in the system, because people are people, they exist there too. You know, you ever hear the phrase, no matter where you go, there you are? No matter where you go, a sinner is going to be there. And so we have to recognize that the Christian university system is not a panacea for all the problems of the world. It's just not. But I do recognize, I think, the reason to withhold, you know, dollars or attendance at something. I recognize that people might say that. On the other hand, I recognize that there are serious glimmers of hope. A lot of the campus ministries do a great job of ministering on campus. I'm part of a thing called the Every Campus Movement, and their goal is to put a gospel fellowship of whether it's InterVarsity or Crew or CCO or Chi Alpha or whatever it is. They want to see a gospel fellowship on every campus in the country. And we're not even close yet, but we're getting there. And Crew, I mean, Michigan State University, is doing a great job of helping and bringing people who have no faith to faith. People are coming to faith all the time at these campus groups. So there is hope there, and there is opportunity and glimmers there as well. So we've chosen to let our kids go to public school, public high school, and to go to a public university if they want to. They don't have to. If they want to, they can. But here's the thing, and I'm going to show you a plug into some ministries. If you help your kids get their worldview right before they get there, it's not a guarantee, but it is a good leg up. It's a good inoculation against sort of indoctrinating to knock the faith out of them. Summit is great. By the way, Summit is no substitution for the dinner table, and they would be the first ones to tell you that. Which is why it's a great ministry, because they wouldn't tell you. You are the greatest influence on your kids' lives, not Summit, not the university. Now, if you have no spiritual influence, they'll become a bigger influence, but you have to do it. So we have a game in my house. We do, it's called Spot the Truth, Spot the Lie. And we watch television. Here's an example, critical thinking. We'll watch television, and we'll pause once in a while and say, we don't do this much anymore, it's just older. But spot the truth, spot the lie. So you'll see something, you say, what's the lie here? Well, the lie is, you know, I don't know, something about, you know, they're trying to get you to buy this thing because that's the letter they use, and you're certain that supermodel does not use Maybelline. You're sure it's certain. Every she uses is probably $45,000 per bottle. So you go through this stuff and you spot the truth as well, because otherwise you can become cynical. I'll give you an example. We're watching a family show. It's I won't name the show, but it's a competition, one of these competition shows. And they always give you a backstory. All the competitors all have these backstories. So you can always tell who the producers want to win, because they have a backstory. pretty much sure that they're going to vote for that person. So the first story is of this guy, young guy, good-looking guy, excellent singer, like, oh my goodness, singer, great guy. He tells his backstory. He was overweight as a kid, got teased a lot, and then he came out as gay and got teased even more. And then he sort of had his ugly duckling moment where he turns into the beautiful goose and all this, and or swan, not goose. Swan is far more poetic than goose. I ruined the whole story. And he tells a story about how singing has helped him elevate himself away from this, and he's found his sense of worth and his sexuality and meaning and all this stuff. And all the people he's fun of for being gay and for being overweight. Next story is a story of a transgender comic. And he talks about how tough it's been to be a transgender comic and people who want to do shows and all that stuff. So he's grateful for the opportunity to be on the show and et cetera, et cetera. The next story is a story of a couple, and they're in a band and they're singing. And their story was they got pregnant out of wedlock and they were the worship leaders at their church and they got kicked out for being pregnant out of wedlock. And Bonham wasn't so, but they stayed with the band and they wanted to make music and they were so grateful for the opportunity to give music. I said, okay, pause. There's a message there. Those three stories are up. There's a message. Spot the truth, spot the lie. So the kids, thank God, pointed out something. What's the truth? It's wrong to make someone feel terrible about themselves because they're overweight, or because they're gay, or because they're trans. You can stick to the truth without making somebody feel awful. You can show them beauty without agreeing with necessarily their views. What's the lie? The lie was the church will kick you out and is terrible because they're so judgmental. So the story is probably true, but the band, what they didn't tell you, what you find out later, is that band, all they were done, they were said, so you can't be the worship leaders right now, you guys have this moral failing, we can't have you be the example for the kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but they were invited back because they got married, they had a beautiful family, and their faith is stronger than ever, and they didn't show that on TV. Here's my point, is that if you don't help the kids have critical thinking skills at home, I don't care what university you send them to, you're not preparing them for whatever comes their way. And I've sat in rooms with young people who told me at Christian universities the huge failings they've had, and does God still love me? So I think it's important to recognize the universities, yes, each decision you make is fine with me. I have no endorsement one way or the other. I can just tell you, either one could result in disaster if you don't take the time to actually engage with kids and young people in their critical thinking skills so they can come inoculated to the onslaught. Mm-hmm. It's not just the universities, it's television, it's Netflix, it's YouTube, it's all that stuff. We have to redeem those issues for you in the universe. Thank you for your question. I think that's... Is there a burning question? I'll take a burning question. Just look warmer, so cool. Okay, you've got to hit me with a good one.
Given that this audience is probably averaging somewhere over 30 people, what would you say would be the number one thing that we could do for the millennial and Gen Z and whatever next generation that's coming along, which in most cases would be our grandkids, what would you say the number one thing we could do for them?
So can I do two? The first one's a don't, actually. Don't engage in gender bashing. Sorry, a generation bashing. It's far too late. He'll be kids today. You know, I do that. I make fun of the music, but this is unlistenable. You know, I do that stuff too. So it's good though, actually. Don't engage in generation bashing. This is something that actually has fostered an animosity where they already have a distrust of older people because they're looking for authenticity and they think that older people have either faked it. And they're not getting caught. I mean, what you're seeing in the media now is every 10 seconds someone is being exposed as a liar. It's usually someone who's older, who's exposed as a liar, and they're saying, my goodness, look at this. These people have taught moral and virtues and family values and none of them live by it. And then that's the same generation who says your generation has it easy and you they don't want to hear it. And they don't they shouldn't have to hear it. They're already going through with anxiety. They don't need to make that, they don't need us to make it worse. So the first one is don't. And I'm gonna tell you this, and this is gonna sound cliche, so but there's a reason these are cliche, because it's often true and true across time. Is we have to live authentically and we have to be listening ears. Just, we don't have to always give them our wisdom up front. Give it to them. You have plenty of it. The older generation has plenty of wisdom, but we also have to listen to what their angst actually is. This is a different generation. You know, our generation, my generation, I'm Gen X, right? So I'm going to be 50 next month, I'm Gen X. There's boomers. And then there's the older than that generation, I don't know what they call them, but the greatest generation, all that stuff, right? Things were different, okay? You walk into an employment area, this is an example of something. You walk into an employment, the first time in the job, and you didn't have to say anything. You know, I remember I became a lawyer in 1989, my job started in 2000. So not that long ago, but I started in 2000. And I remember thinking, I'm a young associate, I came from the number six law school in the country, and I did pretty well. Here I am, and you can feel two ways. They're lucky to have me, or I'm lucky to be here. And I felt the second way. Like, I'm lucky to be here. Thank goodness I have a job at this law firm. It's one of the most prestigious in the mission. And I was in meetings with these partners who have been around for 30 years, and, you know, the Hammurabi Code was law when they started practicing law. I remember thinking to myself, I gotta shut up and just listen to what these people have to say, and I don't want to embarrass myself by saying something. This generation doesn't feel that. They feel they have something to say, they have something to contribute. Sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. But here's the point, sometimes they're right. And they can actually contribute something. That's why what I think the younger generation needs is not people telling them how wrong they're doing, but honing for them how right they can do it if they would just sort of temper it, not stop it, but, you know, massage it, change it, strategically think through it. Get some good counsel here, because a lot of times we go crashing into something thinking it's going to work out, but maybe it'll end up in a failure, horrible failure. I mean, look, this is the generation where they say everything online, and they seem to forget that that stuff never goes away. Mm-hmm. And so I think a tempered, sort of measured way of doing these brilliant, innovative, wonderful things they're capable of doing will only be fostered in a good way if those who've experienced their share of hard knocks can say, hey, that's great, that's awesome, I love this. Why don't we do it this way? What do you think about this? And we try to mentor them. I think mentoring is a big part of it, and that's especially when it comes to the matter of faith. Because if we can show them, this is, I'll tell you three, actually. The third one is this, I think. So first, don't generation bash. Second, engage in mentoring and encouraging that which is valuable about Gen Z, which is valuable about Gen Y, which is valuable about millennials. Encourage those things because there's plenty they have to offer that's great. And because of the lack of mentorship, that results in the problems and the things that they're facing. But when it comes to matters of faith, we're in a culture now where, as I said before, feelings and preferences are elevated above facts and truth. I think that what the older generation can do is say, hey, these feelings and preferences, they can line up with the facts and the truth. And so this constant tension, this constant anxiety you're feeling because your feelings and your preferences are clashing with the world as we know it. And a counselor who once told me that pain is what it feels like when you bump into reality. And so what you want to be true and what actually is true don't always go together, and they clash like this, and it causes pain and anxiety. No wonder young people are experiencing all this pain and anxiety and fear about the world. And so what we can do, as those of us who've experienced the world, and can actually say, I know what the truth actually is, and I want to share this with you, not in a shove it down your throat kind of a way, but by the way, if you come to appreciate that the truth is not anti-you, it's pro-you, that your desires and your preferences will be molded to what the truth actually is, as opposed to you ignoring what the truth is at the benefit of your desires. You see what I'm saying here? Is that our desires need to change to conform to the truth. But you can do it in a compelling way. You can do it in a compassionate way. It doesn't have to be all this shady. You can open-ended. I think that's what your generation has to make some great things. We can share with people who want to do great things. Thank you so much.